was in an open space in which there were many groups of other people, other women, I should say, and a large number of men with guns. I was in a stadium, but it was no longer that. Now it was a prison.
Part 6. 6 for Dead.
Transcript of Witness Testimony 369A. Chapter 13. It has been very difficult for me to tell you about the events surrounding my mother's death. Tabitha had loved me without question. And now she was gone, and everything around me felt wavering and uncertain. Our house, the garden, even my own room, they seemed no longer real, as if they would dissolve into a mist and vanish. I kept thinking of a Bible verse Aunt Vidala had made us learn by heart. 4,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Thou carriest them away as with a flood. They are as asleep. In the morning, they are like grass which groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth and groweth up. In the evening, it is cut down and withereth. Withereth, withereth. It was like lisping, as if God did not know how to speak clearly. A lot of us had stumbled over that word while reciting it. For my mother's funeral, I was given a black dress. Some of the other commanders and their wives were in attendance, and our Marthas. There was a closed coffin with the earthly husk of my mother inside it, and my father made a short speech about what a fine wife she had been, forever thinking of others ahead of herself, an example for all the women of Gilead. And then he said a prayer, thanking God for freeing her from pain, and everyone said Amen. They didn't make a big fuss over the funerals of women in Gilead, even high-ranking ones. The important people came back to our house from the cemetery, and there was a small reception. Zilla had made cheese puffs for it, one of her specialties, and she'd let me help her. That was some comfort, to be allowed to put on an apron, and to grate the cheese, and to squeeze the dough out of the pastry tube onto the baking sheet, and then to watch through the glass window of the oven as it puffed up. We baked these at the last minute, once the people had come. Then I took off the apron and went into the reception in my black dress, as my father had requested, and was silent, as he had also requested. Most of the guests ignored me, except for one of the wives, whose name was Paula. She was a widow, and somewhat famous because her husband, Commander Saunders, had been killed in his study by their handmaid, using a kitchen skewer, a scandal that had been much whispered about at school the year before. What was the handmaid doing in the study? How had she got in? Paula's version was that the girl was insane and had crept downstairs at night and stolen the skewer from the kitchen. And when poor Commander Saunders had opened his study door, she had taken him by surprise, killed a man who had always been respectful to her and to her position. The handmaid had run away, but they'd caught her and hanged her and displayed her on the wall. The other version was Shunammite's, via her Martha, via the main Martha at the Saunders house. It involved violent urges and a sinful connection. The handmaid must have enticed Commander Saunders in some way, and then he'd ordered her to creep downstairs during the nights when everyone was supposed to be asleep. Then she would slither into the study where the commander would be waiting for her, and his eyes would light up like flashlights. Who knows what lustful demands he must have made? Demands that had been unnatural and had driven the handmaid mad. Not that it would take that much with some of them, because they were borderline as it was, but this one must have been worse than most. It did not bear thinking about, said the Marthas. Who could think of little else? When her husband hadn't turned up for breakfast, Paula had gone looking for him and had discovered him lying on the floor without his trousers. Paula had put the trousers back on him before calling the angels. She'd had to order one of her own Marthas to help her. Dead people were either stiff or floppy, and Commander Saunders was a large and clumsily shaped man. Shunammite said the Martha said that Paula had got a lot of blood on herself while wrestling the clothes onto the dead body, and must have nerves of steel because she'd done what was right to save appearances. I preferred Shunammite's version to Paula's. I thought about it at the funeral reception when my father was introducing me to Paula. She was eating a cheese puff. She gave me a measuring look. I'd seen a look like that on Vera when she was poking a straw into a cake to see if it was done. Then she smiled and said, Agnes Jemima, how lovely, and patted me on the head as if I was five, and said it must be nice to have a new dress. I felt like biting her. Was the new dress supposed to make up for my mother being dead? But it was better to hold my tongue than to show my true thoughts. I did not always succeed in that, but I succeeded on this occasion. Thank you, I said. I pictured her kneeling on the floor in a pool of blood, trying to put a pair of trousers on a dead man. This put her in an awkward position in my mind and made me feel better. Several months after my mother's death, my father married the widow Paula. On her finger appeared my mother's magic ring. I suppose my father didn't want to waste it. And why buy another ring when such a beautiful and expensive one was already available? The Marthas grumbled about it. Your mother wanted that ring to go to you, Rosa said. But of course there was nothing they could do. I was enraged, but there was nothing I could do either. I brooded and sulked, but neither my father nor Paula paid any attention to that. They had taken to doing something they called humoring me, which in practice meant ignoring any displays of mood so I would learn that I could not influence them by stubborn silences. They would even discuss this pedagogical technique in front of me while speaking about me in the third person. I see Agnes is in one of her moods. Yes, it is like the weather, it will soon pass. Young girls are like that. Chapter 14. Shortly after my father's wedding to Paula, something very disturbing occurred at school. I am recounting it here not because I wish to be gruesome, but because it made a deep impression on me, and may help to explain why some of us from that time and place acted as we did. This event took place in the religion class, which, as I have mentioned, was taught to us by Aunt Vidala. She was in charge of our school, and indeed of the other schools like ours, the Vidala schools, they were called. But the picture of her that hung at the back of every classroom was smaller than the picture of Aunt Lydia. There were five of these pictures. Baby Nicole at the top, because we had to pray for her safe return every day. Then Aunt Elizabeth and Aunt Helena, then Aunt Lydia, then Aunt Vidala. Baby Nicole and Aunt Lydia had gold frames, whereas the other three only had silver frames. Of course, we all knew who the four women were. They were the founders. But the founders of what, we were not sure, nor did we dare to ask. We did not want to offend Aunt Vidala by calling attention to her smaller picture. Shunammite said that the eyes of the Aunt Lydia picture could follow you around the room and that it could hear what you said. But she exaggerated and made things up. Aunt Vidala sat on top of her big desk. She liked to have a good view of us. She told us to move our desks forward and closer together. Then she said we were now old enough to hear one of the most important stories in the Bible. Important because it was a message from God, especially for girls and women, so we must listen carefully. This was the story of the concubine cut into 12 pieces. Shunammite, sitting beside me, whispered, "I already know this." Becca, on the other side, inched her hand over to mine beneath the desktop. "Shunammite, be silent," said Aunt Vidala. After blowing her nose, she told us the following story. A man's concubine, which was a sort of handmaid, ran away from her owner back to her father's abode. That was very disobedient of her. The man went to collect her, and being a kind and forgiving man, all he asked was to have her back. The father, knowing the rules, said yes. He was disappointed in his daughter for being so disobedient. And the two men had a dinner to celebrate their accord. But this meant that the man and his concubine were late setting out. And when it got dark, they took refuge in a town where the man didn't know anyone. But a generous citizen said they could stay overnight in his house. But some other citizens, being filled with sinful urges, came to the house and demanded that the traveler be handed over to them. They wanted to do shameful things to him, lustful and sinful things. But that would have been especially wicked between men, so the generous man and the traveler put the concubine outside the door instead. "Well, she deserved it, don't you think?" said Aunt Vidala. "She shouldn't have run away. Think of all the suffering she caused to other people." "But when it was morning," said Aunt Vidala, "the traveler opened the door, and the concubine was lying on the threshold." "Get up," the man said to her. But she did not get up, because she was dead. The sinful men had killed her.
"How?" Becca asked. Her voice was barely above a whisper. She was squeezing my hand hard. "How did they kill her?" Two tears were running down her cheeks.
"Many men doing lustful things all at once will kill a girl," said Aunt Vidala. "This story is God's way of telling us that we should be content with our lot and not rebel against it. The man in charge should be honored by the woman," she said. "If not, this was the result. God always made the punishment fit the crime."
I learned the rest of the story later. How the traveler cut the concubine's body into 12 pieces and sent one to each of the tribes of Israel, calling on them to avenge the misuse of his concubine by executing the murderers. And how the tribe of Benjamin refused because the killers were Benjaminites. In the war of vengeance that followed, the tribe of Benjamin was almost obliterated, and their wives and children were all killed. Then the other 11 tribes reasoned that to obliterate the 12th would be bad, so they stopped killing. The remaining Benjaminites couldn't marry any other women officially to make more children, since the rest of the tribes had taken an oath against that. But they were told they could steal some girls and marry them unofficially, which is what they did. But we didn't hear the rest of the story at the time because Becca had burst into tears.
"That is horrible. That is horrible," she said.
The rest of us sat very still.
"Control yourself, Becca," said Aunt Vidala.
But Becca couldn't. She was crying so hard I thought she would stop breathing.
May I give her a hug, Aunt Vidala? I asked at last. We were encouraged to pray for other girls, but not to touch one another.
I suppose so, said Aunt Vidala grudgingly.
I put my arms around Becca, and she wept against my shoulder.
Aunt Vidala was annoyed by the state Becca was in, but she was also concerned. Becca's father was not a commander, only a dentist. But he was an important dentist, and Aunt Vidala had bad teeth. She got up and left the room. After several minutes, Aunt Este arrived. She was the one called in when we needed calming down.
It's all right, Becca, she said. Aunt Vidala didn't mean to frighten you.
This was not exactly true, but Becca stopped crying and began to hiccup.
There's another way of looking at the story. The concubine was sorry for what she had done, and she wanted to make amends, so she sacrificed herself to keep the kind traveler from being killed by those wicked men.
Becca turned her head slightly to the side. She was listening.
That was brave and noble of the concubine, don't you think?
A small nod from Becca. Aunt Este sighed.
We must all make sacrifices in order to help other people, she said in a soothing tone. Men must make sacrifices in war, and women must make sacrifices in other ways. That is how things are divided. Now we may all have a little treat to cheer us up. I have brought us some oatmeal cookies. Girls, you may socialize.
We sat there eating the oatmeal cookies.
Don't be such a baby,
Shunammite whispered across at Becca.
It's only a story.
Becca did not seem to hear her.
I will never, ever get married,
she murmured, almost to herself.
Yes, you will, said Shunammite. Everyone does. No, they don't, said Becca,
but only to me. Chapter 15. A few months after the wedding of Paula and my father, our household received a handmaid. Her name was of Kyle, since my father's name was Commander Kyle.
Her name would have been something else earlier, said Shunammite. Some other man's. They get passed around until they have a baby. They're all sluts anyway. They don't need real names.
Shunammite said a slut was a woman who'd gone with more men than her husband. Though we did not really know what gone with meant. And handmaids must be double sluts, said Shunammite, because they didn't even have husbands.
But you weren't supposed to be rude to the handmaids or call them sluts, said Aunt Vidala, wiping her nose, because they were performing a service to the community by way of atonement, and we should all be grateful to them for that.
I don't see why being a slut is performing a service, Shunammite whispered.
It's because of the babies, I whispered back. The handmaids can make babies.
So can some other women, too, said Shunammite. And they aren't sluts. It was true. Some of the wives could, and some of the Akano wives. We'd seen them with their bulging stomachs. But a lot of women couldn't.
Every woman wanted a baby, said Aunt Este.
Every woman who wasn't an aunt or a Martha. Because if you weren't an aunt or a Martha, said Aunt Vidala, what earthly use were you if you didn't have a baby? What the arrival of this handmaid meant was that my new stepmother, Paula, wanted to have a baby because she did not count me as her child. Tabitha was my mother. But what about Commander Kyle? I didn't seem to count as a child for him either. It was as if I had become invisible to both of them. They looked at me and through me and saw the wall. When the handmaid entered our household, I was almost of womanly age, as Gilead counted. I was taller, my face was longer in shape, and my nose had grown. I had darker eyebrows, not furry caterpillar ones like Shunammite's or wispy ones like Becca's, but curved into half circles and dark eyelashes. My hair had thickened and changed from a mousy brown to chestnut. All of that was pleasing to me, and I would look at my new face in the mirror, turning to take it in from all angles despite warnings against vanity. More alarmingly, my breasts were swelling, and I had begun to sprout hair on areas of my body that we were not supposed to dwell on. Legs, armpits, and the shameful part of many elusive names. Once that happened to a girl, she was no longer a precious flower, but a much more dangerous creature. We'd been prepared for such things at school. Aunt Vidala had presented a series of embarrassing illustrated lectures that were supposed to inform us about a woman's role and duty in regard to her body. A married woman's role. But they had not been very informative or reassuring. When Aunt Vidala asked if there were any questions, there weren't any. Because where would you begin? I wanted to ask why it had to be like this, but I already knew the answer. Because it was God's plan. That was how the aunts got out of everything. Soon I could expect blood to come out from between my legs. That had already happened to many of the girls at school. Why couldn't God have arranged it otherwise? But he had a special interest in blood, which we knew about from scripture verses that had been read out to us. Blood, purification, more blood, more purification, bloodshed to purify the impure, though you weren't supposed to get it on your hands. Blood was polluting, especially when it came out of girls. But God once liked having it spilled on his altars. Though he had given that up, said Aunt Este, in favor of fruits, vegetables, silent suffering, and good deeds. The adult female body was one big booby trap as far as I could tell. If there was a hole, something was bound to be shoved into it, and something else was bound to come out. And that went for any kind of hole. A hole in a wall, a hole in a mountain, a hole in the ground. There were so many things that could be done to it or go wrong with it, this adult female body, that I was left feeling I would be better off without it. I considered shrinking myself by not eating, and I did try that for a day, but I got so hungry I couldn't stick to my resolution and went to the kitchen in the middle of the night and ate chicken scraps out of the soup pot. My effervescent body was not my only worry. My status at school had become noticeably lower. I was no longer deferred to by the others. I was no longer courted. Girls would break off their conversations as I approached and would eye me strangely. Some would even turn their backs. Becca did not do that. She still contrived to sit beside me. But she looked straight ahead and did not slip her hand under the desk to hold mine. Shunammite was still claiming to be my friend, partly, I am sure, because she was not popular among the others. But now she was doing me the favor of friendship instead of the other way around. I was hurt by all of this, though I didn't yet understand why the atmosphere had changed. The others knew, however. Word must have been going around, from mouth to ear to mouth. From my stepmother, Paula, through our Marthas, who noticed everything, and then from them to the other Marthas they would encounter when doing errands, and then from those Marthas to their wives, and from the wives to their daughters, my schoolmates. What was the word? in part, that I was out of favor with my powerful father. My mother, Tabitha, had been my protectress, but now she was gone, and my stepmother did not wish me well. At home, she would ignore me, or she would bark at me. Pick that up. Don't slouch. I tried to keep out of her sight as much as possible, but even my closed door must have been an affront to her. She would have known that I was concealed behind it, thinking acid thoughts. But my fall in value went beyond the loss of my father's favor. There was a new piece of information circulating, one that was very harmful to me. Whenever there was a secret to tell, especially a shocking one, Shunammite loved to be the messenger.
Guess what I found out?
She said one day while we were eating our lunchtime sandwiches. It was a sunny noon. We were being allowed to have a picnic outside on the school lawn. The grounds were enclosed by a high fence topped with razor wire, and there were two angels at the gate, which was locked, except when the aunt's cars went in and out. So we were perfectly safe. What? I said. The sandwiches were an artificial cheese mixture that had replaced real cheese in our school sandwiches because the real cheese was needed by our soldiers. The sunlight was warm. The grass was soft. I had made it out of the house that day without Paula seeing me, and for the moment I was feeling marginally content with my life.
Your mother wasn't your real mother, said Shunammite. They took you away from your real mother because she was a slut. But don't worry, it's not your fault because you were too young to know that.
My stomach clenched. I spat a mouthful of sandwich onto the grass.
That's not true!
I almost shouted.
Calm down, said Shunammite. Like I said, it's not your fault. I don't believe you, I said.
Shunammite gave a pitying, relishing smile.
It's the truth. My Martha heard the whole story from your Martha, and she heard it from your new stepmother. The wives know about things like that. Some of them got their own kids that way. Not me, though. I was born properly.
I really hated her at that moment. Then where's my real mother? I demanded.
If you know everything. You are really, really mean, I wanted to say.
It was dawning on me that she must have betrayed me before telling me she'd already told the other girls. That's why they'd become so cool. I was tainted.
I don't know. Maybe she's dead, Shunammite said. She was stealing you from Gilead. She was trying to run away through a forest. She was going to take you across the border. But they caught up with her and rescued you.
Lucky for you.
Who did?
I asked faintly. While telling me this story, Shunammite was continuing to chew. I watched her mouth, out of which my doom was emerging. There was orange cheese substitute between her teeth.
You know, them. The angels and eyes and them. They rescued you and gave you to Tabitha because she couldn't have a baby. They were doing you a favor. You have a much better home now than with that slut.
I felt belief creeping up through my body like a paralysis. The story Tabitha used to tell. About rescuing me and running away from the evil witches. It was partly true. But it hadn't been Tabitha's hand I'd been holding. It had been the hand of my real mother. My real mother. The slut. And it wasn't witches chasing us. It was men. They would have had guns. Because such men always did. Tabitha did choose me, though. She chose me from among all the other children pried loose from their mothers and fathers. She chose me, and she cherished me. She loved me. That part was real. But now I was motherless. because where was my real mother? I was fatherless as well. Commander Kyle was no more related to me than the man in the moon. He'd only tolerated me because I was Tabitha's project. Her plaything. Her pet. No wonder Paula and Commander Kyle wanted a handmaid. They wanted a real child instead of me. I was nobody's child. Shunammite continued to chew, watching with satisfaction as her message sank in. "I'll stick up for you," she said in her most pious and insincere voice. "It doesn't make any difference to your soul. Aunt Este says all souls are equal in heaven." Only in heaven, I thought. And this is not heaven. This is a place of snakes and ladders, and though I was once high up on a ladder propped against the tree of life, now I've slid down a snake. How gratifying for the others to witness my fall. No wonder Shunammite could not resist spreading such baleful and pleasing news. Already I could hear the snickering behind my back. "Slut, slut, daughter of a slut." Aunt Vidala and Aunt Este must know as well. The two of them must always have known. It was the kind of secret the aunts knew. That was how they got their power, according to the Marthas. From knowing secrets. And Aunt Lydia, whose frown-smiling, gold-framed picture with the ugly brown uniform hung at the backs of our schoolrooms, must know the most secrets of all, because she had the most power. What would Aunt Lydia have to say about my plight? Would she help me? Would she understand my unhappiness? Would she save me? But was Aunt Lydia even a real person? I had never seen her. Maybe she was like God. Real but unreal at the same time. What if I were to pray to Aunt Lydia at night, instead of to God? I did try later in the week, but the idea was too unthinkable. Praying to a woman. So I stopped. Chapter 16. I went through the rest of that terrible afternoon as if sleepwalking. We were embroidering sets of petty point handkerchiefs for the aunts, with flowers on them to go with their names. Echinacea for Elizabeth, hyacinths for Helena, violets for Vidala. I was doing lilacs for Lydia, and I stuck a needle halfway into my finger without noticing it until Shunammite said, "There's blood on your petty point." Gabriella, a scrawny, smart-mouthed girl who was now as popular as I had once been because her father had been promoted to three Marthas, whispered, "Maybe she's finally getting her period out her finger." And everyone laughed, because most of them already had theirs, even Becca. Aunt Vidala heard the laughing and looked up from her book and said, "That's enough of that." Aunt Este took me to the washroom and we rinsed off the blood on my hand, and she put a bandage on my finger, but the petty point handkerchief had to be soaked in cold water, which is the way we'd been taught that you got out blood, especially from white cloth. Getting out blood was something we would have to know as wives, said Aunt Vidala, as it would be part of our duties. We would have to supervise our Marthas to make sure they did it right. Cleaning up things such as blood and other substances that came out of bodies was part of women's duty of caring for other people, especially little children and the elderly, said Aunt Este, who always put things in a positive light. That was a talent women had because of their special brains, which were not hard and focused like the brains of men, but soft and damp and warm and enveloping, like what? She didn't finish the sentence, Like mud in the sun, I thought. That's what was inside my head. Warmed up mud. Is anything wrong, Agnes? Aunt Este asked after my finger had been cleaned up. I said no.
Then why are you crying, my dear?
It seemed that I was. Tears were coming out of my eyes, out of my damp and muddy head, despite my effort to control them.
Because it hurts,
I said, sobbing now. She didn't ask what hurt, though she must have known it wasn't really my needled finger. She put her arm around me and gave me a little squeeze.
So many things hurt, she said. But we must try to be cheerful. God likes cheerfulness. He likes us to appreciate the nice things in the world.
We heard a lot about the likes and dislikes of God from the aunts who taught us, especially Aunt Vidala, who seemed to be on very close terms. Shunammite once said she was going to ask Aunt Vidala what God liked for breakfast, which scandalized the more timid girls. But she never actually did it. I wondered what God thought about mothers, both real and unreal. But I knew there was no point in questioning Aunt Este about my real mother and how Tabitha had chosen me, or even how old I'd been at the time. The aunts at school avoided talking to us about our parents. When I got home that day, I cornered Zilla in the kitchen where she was making biscuits and repeated everything that Shunammite had told me at lunchtime. Your friend has a big mouth, was what she said. She should keep it shut more often. Unusually harsh words coming from her. But is it true? I said. I still half hoped then that she would deny the whole story. She sighed. How'd you like to help me make the biscuits? But I was too old to be bribed with simple gifts like that. Just tell me, I said. Please. Well, she said. According to your new stepmother, yes. That story is true. Or something like it. So Tabitha wasn't my mother, I said, holding back the fresh tears that were coming, keeping my voice steady. It depends what you mean by a mother, said Zilla. Is your mother the one who gives birth to you, or the one who loves you the most? I don't know, I said. Maybe the one who loves you the most? Then Tabitha was your mother, said Zilla, cutting out the biscuits. And we Marthas are your mothers too, because we love you as well, though it may not always seem so to you. She lifted each round biscuit with the pancake flipper and placed it onto the baking sheet. We all have your best interests at heart. This made me distrust her a little, because Aunt Vidala said similar things about our best interests, usually before doling out a punishment. She liked to switch us on the legs where it wouldn't show, and sometimes higher up, making us bend over and raise our skirts. Sometimes she would do that to a girl in front of the whole class.
What happened to her? I asked. My other mother. The one who was running through the forest? After they took me away? I don't truly know, said Zilla, not looking at me, sliding the biscuits into the hot oven.
I wanted to ask if I could have one when they came out. I craved warm biscuits, but this seemed like a childish request to make in the middle of such a serious conversation.
Did they shoot her? Did they kill her? Oh, no, said Zilla. They wouldn't have done that. Why? Because she could have babies. She had you, didn't she? That was proof she could. They would never kill a valuable woman like that, unless they really couldn't help it. She paused to let this sink in. Most likely, they would see if she could be. The aunts at the Rachel and Leah Center would pray with her. They would talk to her at first, to see if it was possible to change her mind about things. There were rumors about the Rachel and Leah Center at school, but they were vague. None of us knew what went on inside it. Still, just being prayed over by a bunch of aunts would be scary. Not all of them were as gentle as Aunt Este. And what if they couldn't change her mind? I asked. Would they kill her then? Is she dead? Oh, I'm sure they changed her mind, said Zilla. They're good at that. Hearts and minds. They change them. Where is she now, then? I asked. My mother, the other one. I wondered if that mother remembered me. She must remember me. She must have loved me, or she wouldn't have tried to take me with her when she was running away. None of us know that, dear, said Zilla. Once they become handmaids, they don't have their old names anymore. And in those outfits they wear, you can hardly see their faces. They all look the same. She's a handmaid? I asked. It was true then, what Shunammite had said. My mother? That's what they do over at the center, said Zilla. They make them into handmaids, one way or another. The ones they catch. Now, how about a nice hot biscuit? I don't have any butter right now, but I can put a little honey on it for you. I thanked her. I ate the biscuit. My mother was a handmaid. That's why Shunammite insisted she was a slut. It was common knowledge that all the handmaids had been sluts. Once upon a time. And they still were. Although, in a different way. From then on, our new handmaid fascinated me. I'd ignored her when she'd first come, as instructed. It was the kindest thing for them, said Rosa, because either she would have a baby and then be moved somewhere else, or she wouldn't have a baby and would be moved somewhere else anyway. But in any case, she wouldn't be in our house for long. So it was bad for them to form attachments, especially with any young people in the household, because they would only have to give those attachments up and think how upsetting that would be for them. So I'd turned away from Avkile and had pretended not to notice her when she'd glide into the kitchen in her red dress to pick up the shopping basket and then go for her walk. The handmaids all went for a walk every day, two by two. You could see them on the sidewalks. Nobody bothered them or spoke to them or touched them because they were, in a sense, untouchable. But now I gazed at Avkile from the sides of my eyes at every chance I got. She had a pale oval face, blank, like a gloved thumbprint. I knew how to make a blank face myself, so I didn't believe she was really blank underneath. She'd had a whole other life. What had she looked like when she'd been a slut? Sluts went with more than one man. How many men had she gone with? What did that mean exactly, going with men? And what sort of men? Had she allowed parts of her body to stick out of her clothing? Had she worn trousers like a man? That was so unholy, it was almost unimaginable. But if she'd done that, how daring! She must have been very different from the way she was now. She must have had a lot more energy. I would go to the window to watch her from behind
as she went out for her walk, through our garden and down the path to our front gate. Then I would take off my shoes, tiptoe along the hall, and creep into her room, which was at the back of the house, on the third floor. It was a medium-sized room with its own bathroom attached. It had a braided rug. On the wall there was a picture of blue flowers in a vase that used to belong to Tabitha. My stepmother had put the picture in there to get it out of sight, I suppose, because she was purging the visible parts of the house of anything that might remind her new husband of his first wife. Paula wasn't doing it openly. She was more subtle than that. She was moving or discarding one thing at a time, but I knew what she was up to. It was one more reason for me to dislike her. Why mince words? I don't need to do that anymore. I didn't just dislike her. I hated her. Hatred is a very bad emotion because it curdles the soul. Aunt Este taught us that. But although I'm not proud to admit it, and I used to pray to be forgiven for it, hatred is indeed what I felt. Once I was inside our handmaid's room and had closed the door softly, I would poke around in there. Who was she really? And what if she was my missing mother? I knew this was make-believe, but I was so lonely. I liked to think of how things would be if it were true. We would fling ourselves into each other's arms. We would hug each other. We would be so happy to have found each other again. But then, what? I had no version of what might happen after that, though I had a dim idea that it would be trouble. There was nothing in of Kyle's room that provided any clue about her. Her red dresses were hanging in the closet in an orderly row. Her plain white underthings and her sack-like nightgowns were folded neatly on the shelves. She had a second pair of walking shoes and an extra cloak and a spare white bonnet. She had a toothbrush with a red handle. There was a suitcase she'd brought these things in, but it was empty. Chapter 17. Finally, our handmaid managed to get pregnant. I knew this before I was told, because instead of treating her as if she were a stray dog they were putting up with out of pity, the Marthas began fussing over her and giving her bigger meals, and placing flowers in little vases on her breakfast trays. Because of my obsession with her, I kept track of details like that as much as I could. I would listen to the Marthas talking excitedly in the kitchen when they thought I wasn't there, though I couldn't always hear what they said. When I was with them, Zilla smiled to herself a lot, and Vera lowered her harsh voice as if she was in church. Even Rosa had a smug expression, as if she'd eaten a particularly delicious orange but was not telling anyone about it. As for Paula, my stepmother, she was glowing. She was nicer to me on those occasions when we were together in the same room, which were not frequent if I could help it. I snatched breakfast in the kitchen before being driven to school, and I left the dinner table as quickly as I could, pleading homework, some piece of petty point or knitting or sewing, a drawing I had to finish, a watercolor I needed to paint. Paula never objected. She didn't want to see me any more than I wanted to see her. "Of Kyle's pregnant, isn't she?" I asked Zilla one morning. I tried to be casual about it in case I was wrong. Zilla was caught off guard.
"How did you know?" she asked.
"I'm not blind," I said in a superior voice that must have been irritating. I was at that age.
"We aren't supposed to say anything about it," said Zilla, "until after the third month. The first 3 months are the danger time."
"Why?" I said. I didn't really know much after all, despite Aunt Vidala's runny-nosed slideshow about fetuses. Because if it's an unbaby, that's when it might get born too early, said Zilla. And it would die. I knew about unbabies. They were not taught, but they were whispered about. There were said to be a lot of them. Becca's handmaid had given birth to a baby girl. It didn't have a brain. Poor Becca had been very upset because she'd wanted a sister. We're praying for it. For her, Zilla had said then. I'd noticed the it. Paula must have dropped a hint among the other wives about of Kyle being pregnant, though, because my status at school suddenly shot upwards again. Shunammite and Becca competed for my attention, as before, and the other girls deferred to me as if I had an invisible aura. A coming baby shed luster on everyone connected with it. It was as if a golden haze had enveloped our house, and the haze got brighter and more golden as time passed. When the three-month mark was reached, there was an unofficial party in the kitchen and Zilla made a cake. As for of Kyle, her expression was not so much joyful as relieved from what I could glimpse of her face. In the midst of this repressed jubilation, I myself was a dark cloud. This unknown baby inside of Kyle was taking up all the love. There seemed to be none left anywhere for me. I was all alone. And I was jealous. That baby would have a mother, and I would never have one. Even the Marthas were turning away from me, towards the light shining out of Kyle's belly. I am ashamed to admit it. Jealous of a baby. But that was the truth. It was at this time that an event took place that I should pass over because it's better forgotten. But it had a bearing on the choice I was soon to make. Now that I'm older and have seen more of the outside world, I can see that it might not seem that significant to some, but I was a young girl from Gilead, and I had not been exposed to these kinds of situations. So this event was not trivial to me. Instead, it was horrifying. It was also shameful. When a shameful thing is done to you, the shamefulness rubs off on you. You feel dirtied. The prelude was minor. I needed to go to the dentist for my yearly checkup. The dentist was Becca's father, and his name was Dr. Grove. He was the best dentist, said Vera. All the top commanders and their families went to him. His office was in the Blessings of Health building, which was for doctors and dentists. It had a picture of a smiling heart and a smiling tooth on the outside. One of the Marthas always used to go with me to the doctor or the dentist and sit in the waiting room as it was more proper that way, Tabitha used to say, without explaining why. But Paula said the guardian could just drive me there, since there was too much work to be done in the house considering the changes that had to be prepared for, by which she meant the baby. And it would be a waste of time to send a Martha. I did not mind. In fact, going by myself made me feel very grown up. I sat up straight in the back seat of the car behind our guardian. Then I went into the building and pressed the elevator button that had three teeth on it, and found the right floor and the right door and sat in the waiting room looking at the pictures of transparent teeth on the wall. When it was my turn, I went into the inner room as the assistant, Mr. William, asked me to do, and sat down in the dentist chair. Dr. Grove came in, and Mr. William brought my chart, and then went out and closed the door, and Dr. Grove looked at my chart and asked if I had any problems with my teeth, and I said no. He poked around in my mouth with his picks and probes and his little mirror, as usual. As usual, I saw his eyes up close, magnified by his glasses, blue and bloodshot, with elephant knee eyelids, and tried not to breathe in when he was breathing out because his breath smelled, as usual, of onions. He was a middle-aged man with no distinguishing features. He snapped off his white, stretchy sanitary gloves and washed his hands at the sink, which was behind my back. He said, "Perfect teeth. Perfect." Then he said, "You're getting to be a big girl, Agnes." Then he put his hand on my small but growing breast. It was summer, so I was wearing the summer school uniform, which was pink and made of light cotton. I froze in shock. So it was all true then, about men and their rampaging, fiery urges. And merely by sitting in the dentist chair, I was the cause. I was horribly embarrassed. What was I supposed to say? I didn't know. So I simply pretended it wasn't happening. Dr. Grove was standing behind me. So it was his left hand on my left breast. I couldn't see the rest of him, only his hand, which was large and had reddish hairs on the back. It was warm. It sat there on my breast like a large, hot crab. I didn't know what to do. Should I take hold of his hand and move it off my breast? Would that cause even more burning lust to break forth? Should I try to get away? Then the hand squeezed my breast. The fingers found my nipple and pinched. It was like having a thumbtack stuck into me. I moved the upper part of my body forward. I needed to get out of that dentist chair as fast as I could, but the hand was locking me in. Suddenly, it lifted, and then some of the rest of Dr. Grove moved into sight. "About time you saw one of these," he said in the normal voice in which he said everything. "You'll have one of them inside you soon enough." He took hold of my right hand and positioned it on this part of himself. I don't think I need to tell you what happened next. He had a towel handy. He wiped himself off and tucked his appendage back into his trousers. "There," he said. "Good girl. I didn't hurt you." He gave me a fatherly pat on the shoulder. "Don't forget to brush twice a day and floss afterwards. Mr. William will give you a new toothbrush." I walked out of the room feeling sick to my stomach. Mr. William was in the waiting room, his unobtrusive 30-year-old face impassive. He held out a bowl with new pink and blue toothbrushes in it. I knew enough to take a pink one. "Thank you," I said.
"You're welcome," said Mr. William. "Any cavities?"
"No," I said. "Not this time."
"Good," said Mr. William. "Keep away from the sweet things and maybe you'll never have any. Any decay. Are you all right?"
"Yes," I said. Where was the door?
"You look pale. Some people have a fear of dentists."
Was that a smirk? Did he know what had just happened?
"I'm not pale," I said stupidly. How could I tell I wasn't pale? I found the door handle and blundered out, reached the elevator, pressed the down button.
Was this now going to happen every time I went to the dentist? I couldn't say I didn't want to go back to Dr. Grove without saying why. And if I said why, I knew I would be in trouble.
The onset school taught us that you should tell someone in authority, meaning them, if any man touched you inappropriately. But we knew not to be so dumb as to make a fuss, especially if it was a well-respected man like Dr. Grove.
Also, what would it do to Becca if I said that about her father? She would be humiliated. She would be devastated. It would be a terrible betrayal.
Some girls had reported such things, One had claimed their guardian had run his hands over her legs. Another had said that an Econo trash collector had unzipped his trousers in front of her. The first girl had had the backs of her legs whipped for lying. The second had been told that nice girls did not notice the minor antics of men. They simply looked the other way. But I could not have looked the other way. There had been no other way to look. "I don't want any dinner," I said to Zilla in the kitchen. She gave me a sharp glance. "Did your dentist appointment go all right, dear?" she said. "Any cavities?" "No," I said. I tried a wan smile. "I have perfect teeth."
"Are you ill?"
"Maybe I'm catching a cold," I said. "I just need to lie down." Zilla made me a hot drink with lemon and honey in it and brought it up to my room on a tray. "I should have gone with you," she said. "But he's the best dentist. Everyone agrees." She knew, or she suspected. She was warning me not to say anything. That was the kind of coded language they used. Or I should say, that we all used. Did Paula know too? Did she foresee that such a thing would happen to me at Dr. Grove's? Is that why she sent me by myself? It must have been so, I decided. She'd done it on purpose, so I would have my breast pinched and that polluting item thrust in front of me. She'd wanted me to be defiled. That was a word from the Bible. Defiled. She was probably having a malicious laugh about it. About the nasty joke she'd played on me. For I could see that in her eyes, it would be viewed as a joke. After that, I stopped praying for forgiveness about the hatred I felt towards her. I was right to hate her. I was prepared to think the very worst of her, and I did. Chapter 18. The months passed. My life of tiptoeing and eavesdropping continued. I worked hard at seeing without being seen, and hearing without being heard. I discovered the cracks between door frames and nearly closed doors. The listening posts in hallways and on stairs, the thin places and walls. Most of what I heard came in fragments and even silences, but I was becoming good at fitting these fragments together and filling in the unsaid parts of sentences. Of Kyle, our handmaid, got bigger and bigger, or her stomach did, and the bigger she got, the more ecstatic our household became. I mean, the women became ecstatic. As for Commander Kyle, it was hard to tell what he felt. He'd always had a wooden face, and anyway, men were not supposed to display emotions in such ways as crying, or even laughing out loud. Though a certain amount of laughing did go on behind the closed dining room doors when he'd have his groups of commanders over for dinner. With wine and one of the party desserts involving whipped cream, when obtainable, that Zilla made so well. But I suppose even he was at least moderately thrilled about the ballooning of Kyle. Sometimes I wondered what my own father might have felt about me. I had some notions about my mother. She'd run away with me. She'd been turned into a handmaid by the aunts. But none at all about my father. I must have had one. Everyone did. You'd think I'd have filled up the blank with idealized pictures of him, but I didn't. The blank remained blank. Of Kyle was now quite a celebrity. Wives would send their handmaids over with some excuse. Borrowing an egg, returning a bowl, but really to ask how she was doing. They would be allowed inside the house. Then she would be called down so they could put their hands on her round belly and feel the baby kicking. It was amazing to see the expression on their faces while they were performing this ritual. Wonder, as if they were witnessing a miracle. Hope, because if Avkayil could do it, so could they. Envy, because they weren't doing it yet. Longing, because they really wanted to do it. Despair, because it might never happen for them. I did not yet know what might become of a handmaid who, despite having been judged viable, came up barren through all her allotted postings. But I already guessed it would not be good. Paula threw numerous tea parties for the other wives. They would congratulate her and admire her and envy her, and she would smile graciously and accept their congratulations modestly and say all blessings came from above. And then she would order Avkayil to appear in the living room so the wives could see for themselves and exclaim over her and make a fuss. They might even call Avkayil dear, which they never did for an ordinary handmaid, one with a flat stomach. Then they would ask Paula what she was going to name her baby. Her baby, not Avkayil's baby. I wondered what Avkayil thought about that, but none of them were interested in what was going on in her head. They were only interested in her belly.